I know my own reasons for keeping Peter alive. He's my friend, and this is my way to defy the capital, to subvert its terrible games. But if I had no real ties to him, what would make me want to save him, to choose him over myself? Certainly he is brave, but we have all been brave enough to survive a games. There is that quality of goodness that's hard to overlook, but still. And then I think of it, what Peter can do so much better than the rest of us. He can use words. He obliterated the rest of the field at both interviews, and maybe it's because of that underlying goodness that he can move a crowd, no, a country, to his side with the turn of a simple sentence. I remember thinking that was the gift the leader of our revolution should have. Has Haymitch convinced the others of this, that Peter's tongue would have far greater power against the capital than any physical strength the rest of us could claim? I don't know. It still seems like a really long leap for some of the tributes. I mean, we're talking about Joanna Mason here. But what other explanation can there be for their decided efforts to keep him alive?
Katniss, got that spile? Finnick asks, snapping me back to reality.
I cut the vine that ties the spile to my belt and hold the metal tube out to him. That's when I hear the scream, so full of fear and pain it ices my blood, and so familiar. I drop the spile, forget where I am or what lies ahead, only know I must reach her, protect her. I run wildly in the direction of the voice, heedless of danger, ripping through vines and branches, through anything that keeps me from reaching her. From reaching my little sister. Chapter 24.
Where is she? What are they doing to her? Prim! I cry out. Prim!
Only another agonized scream answers me.
How did she get here? Why is she part of the games? Prim!
Vines cut into my face and arms. Creepers grab my feet. But I am getting closer to her. Closer. Very close now. Sweat pours down my face, stinging the healing acid wounds. I pant, trying to get some use out of the warm, moist air that seems empty of oxygen. Prim makes a sound. Such a lost, irretrievable sound that I can't even imagine what they have done to evoke it.
Prim!
I rip through a wall of green into a small clearing, and the sound repeats directly above me. Above me? My head whips back. Do they have her up in the trees? I desperately search the branches, but see nothing.
Prim!
I say pleadingly. I hear her, but can't see her. Her next wail rings out, clear as a bell, and there's no mistaking the source. It's coming from the mouth of a small crested black bird, perched on a branch about 10 feet over my head. And then I understand. It's a Japperjay. I've never seen one before. I thought they no longer existed. And for a moment, as I lean against the trunk of the tree, clutching the stitch in my side, I examine it. The mutation, the forerunner, the father. I pull up a mental image of a mockingbird, fuse it with the Jabberjay, and yes, I can see how they mated to make my mockingjay. There is nothing about the bird that suggests it's a mutt. Nothing except the horribly lifelike sounds of Prim's voice streaming from its mouth. I silence it with an arrow in its throat. The bird falls to the ground. I remove my arrow and wring its neck for good measure. Then I hurl the revolting thing into the jungle. No degree of hunger would ever tempt me to eat it. It wasn't real, I tell myself. The same way the mutation wolves last year weren't really the dead tributes. It's just a sadistic trick of the game makers. Finnick crashes into the clearing to find me wiping my arrow clean with some moss.
Katniss!
It's okay. I'm okay.
I say, although I don't feel okay at all. I thought I heard my sister, but... The piercing shriek cuts me off. It's another voice. Not Prim's. Maybe a young woman's. I don't recognize it. But the effect on Finnick is instantaneous. The color vanishes from his face, and I can actually see his pupils dilate in fear. "Finnick, wait!" I say, reaching out to reassure him. But he's bolted away, gone off in pursuit of the victim, as mindlessly as I pursued Prim. "Finnick!" I call, but I know he won't turn back and wait for me to give a rational explanation, so all I can do is follow him. It's no effort to track him, even though he's moving so fast, since he leaves a clear, trampled path in his wake. But the bird is at least a quarter mile away, most of it uphill, and by the time I reach him, I'm winded. He's circling around a giant tree. The trunk must be 4 feet in diameter, and the limbs don't even begin until 20 feet up. The woman's shrieks emanate from somewhere in the foliage. But the jabberjay's concealed. Finnick screaming as well, over and over. "Annie! Annie!" He's in a state of panic and completely unreachable, so I do what I would do anyway. I scale an adjacent tree, locate the jabberjay, and take it out with an arrow. It falls straight down, landing right at Finnick's feet. He picks it up, slowly making the connection, but when I slide down to join him, he looks more despairing than ever. "It's all right, Finnick. It's just a jabberjay. They're playing a trick on us," I say. "It's not real. It's not your... Annie." "No, it's not Annie, but the voice was hers. Jabberjays mimic what they hear. Where did they get those screams, Katniss?" he says. I can feel my own cheeks grow pale as I understand his meaning. "Oh, Finnick, you don't think they..."
"Yes, I do. That's exactly what I think," he says.
I have an image of Prim in a white room, strapped to a table, while masked, robed figures elicit those sounds from her. Somewhere they are torturing her, or did torture her, to get those sounds. My knees turn to water and I sink to the ground. Finnick is trying to tell me something, but I can't hear him. What I do finally hear is another bird starting up somewhere off to my left, and this time the voice is Gale's. Finnick catches my arm before I can run.
"No, it's not him."
He starts pulling me downhill toward the beach. "We're getting out of here." But Gale's voice is so full of pain I can't help struggling to reach it.
"It's not him, Katniss. It's a mutt," Finnick shouts at me. "Come on."
He moves me along, half dragging, half carrying me, until I can process what he said. He's right. It's just another jabberjay. I can't help Gale by chasing it down. But that doesn't change the fact that it is Gale's voice, and somewhere, sometime, someone has made him sound like this. I stop fighting Finnick, though, and like the night in the fog, I flee what I can't fight, what can only do me harm. Only this time it's my heart and not my body that's disintegrating. This must be another weapon of the clock. 4 o'clock, I guess. When the hands tick-tock onto the 4, the monkeys go home, and the jabberjays come out to play. Finnick is right. Getting out of here is the only thing to do, although there will be nothing Haymitch can send in a parachute that will help either Finnick or me recover from the wounds the birds have inflicted. I catch sight of Peeta and Joanna standing at the tree line, and I'm filled with a mixture of relief and anger. Why didn't Peeta come to help me? Why did no one come after us? Even now he hangs back, his hands raised, palms toward us, lips moving, but no words reaching us. Why? The wall is so transparent, Finnick and I run smack into it and bounce back onto the jungle floor. I'm lucky. My shoulder took the worst part of the impact, whereas Finnick hit face first, and now his nose is gushing blood. This is why Peter and Joanna and even Beatty, who I see sadly shaking his head behind them, have not come to our aid. An invisible barrier blocks the area in front of us. It's not a force field. You can touch the hard, smooth surface all you like. But Peter's knife and Joanna's axe can't make a dent in it. I know, without checking more than a few feet to one side, that it encloses the entire 4 to 5 o'clock wedge, that we will be trapped like rats until the hour passes. Peter presses his hand against the surface, and I put my own up to meet it, as if I can feel him through the wall. I see his lips moving, but I can't hear him, can't hear anything outside our wedge. I try to make out what he's saying, but I can't focus, so I just stare at his face, doing my best to hang on to my sanity. Then the birds begin to arrive, one by one, perching in the surrounding branches, and a carefully orchestrated chorus of horror begins to spill out of their mouths. Finnick gives up at once, hunching on the ground, clenching his hands over his ears, as if he's trying to crush his skull. I try to fight for a while, emptying my quiver of arrows into the hated birds, but every time one drops dead, another quickly takes its place. And finally I give up and curl up beside Finnick, trying to block out the excruciating sounds of Prim, Gail, my mother, Madge, Rory, Vic, even Posy. Helpless little Posy. I know it's stopped when I feel Peter's hands on me, feel myself lifted from the ground and out of the jungle. But I stay, eyes squeezed shut, hands over my ears, muscles too rigid to release. Peter holds me on his lap, speaking soothing words, rocking me gently. Takes a long time before I begin to relax the iron grip on my body, and when I do, the trembling begins. "It's all right, Katniss," he whispers. "You didn't hear them," I answer. "I heard Prim, right in the beginning, but it wasn't her," he says. "It was a Jabberjay." "It was her, somewhere. The Jabberjay just recorded it," I say. "No, that's what they want you to think, the same way I wondered if Glimmer's eyes were in that mutt last year. But those weren't Glimmer's eyes, and that wasn't Prim's voice. Or if it was, they took it from an interview or something and distorted the sound. Made it say whatever she was saying," he says. "No, they were torturing her," I answer. "She's probably dead."
"Katniss, Prim isn't dead. How could they kill Prim? We're almost down to the final 8 of us. And what happens then?" Peter says.
7 more of us die," I say hopelessly.
"No, back home. What happens when they reach the final 8 tributes in the games?"
He lifts my chin so I have to look at him, forces me to make eye contact. "What happens at the final 8? I know he's trying to help me, so I make myself think. "At the final 8? I repeat. "They interview your family and friends back home."
"That's right," says Peter. "They interview your family and friends. And can they do that if they've killed them all?"
"No," I ask, still unsure.
"No. That's how we know Prim's alive. She'll be the first one they interview, won't she?" he asks.
I want to believe him, badly. It's just those voices.
"First Prim, then your mother, your cousin Gail, Madge," he continues. "It was a trick, Katniss, a horrible one.
But we're the only ones who can be hurt by it.
We're the ones in the games, not them."
"You really believe that?" I say.
"I really do," says Peter.
I waver, thinking of how Peter can make anyone believe anything. I look over at Finnick for confirmation, see he's fixated on Peter, his words. "Do you believe it, Finnick?" I ask.
"It could be true. I don't know," he says.
Could they do that, Beatty? Take someone's regular voice and make it...
Oh, yes. It's not even that difficult, Finnick. Our children learn a similar technique in school, says Beatty.
Of course Peeta's right. The whole country adores Katniss's little sister. If they really killed her like this, they'd probably have an uprising on their hands, says Joanna flatly. Don't want that, do they?
She throws back her head and shouts,
Whole country in rebellion? Wouldn't want anything like that.
My mouth drops open in shock. No one ever says anything like this in the games. Absolutely, they've cut away from Joanna or editing her out. But I have heard her and can never think about her again in the same way. She'll never win any awards for kindness, but she certainly is gutsy. Or crazy.
She picks up some shells and heads toward the jungle. I'm getting water, she says.
I can't help catching her hand as she passes me.
Don't go in there, the birds.
I remember the birds must be gone, but I still don't want anyone in there, not even her.
They can't hurt me. I'm not like the rest of you. There's no one left I love,
Joanna says, and frees her hand with an impatient shake. When she brings me back a shell of water, I take it with a silent nod of thanks, knowing how much she would despise the pity in my voice. While Joanna collects water and my arrows, Beatty fiddles with his wire, and Finnick takes to the water. I need to clean up too, but I stay in Peeta's arms, still too shaken to move.
Who did they use against Finnick? He asks.
Somebody named Annie, I say.
Must be Annie Cresta, he says.
Who?
I ask.
Annie Cresta. She was the girl Mags volunteered for. She won about 5 years ago, says Peeta.
That would have been the summer after my father died, when I first began feeding my family, when my whole being was occupied with battling starvation. I don't remember those games much, I say. Was that the earthquake year?
Yeah. Annie's the one who went mad when her district partner got beheaded, ran off by herself and hid. But an earthquake broke a dam and most of the arena got flooded. She won because she was the best swimmer, says Peeta.
Did she get better after? I ask. I mean, her mind?
I don't know. I don't remember ever seeing her at the games again. But she didn't look too stable during the reaping this year, says Peeta.
So that's who Finnick loves, I think. Not his string of fancy lovers in the capital, but a poor, mad girl back home.
A cannon blast brings us all together on the beach. A hovercraft appears in what we estimate to be the 6 to 7 o'clock zone. We watch as the claw dips down 5 different times to retrieve the pieces of one body torn apart. It's impossible to tell who it was. Whatever happens at 6 o'clock, I never want to know.
Peeta draws a new map on a leaf, adding a JJ for Jabberjays in the 4 to 5 o'clock section and simply writing Beast in the one where we saw the tribute collected in pieces. We now have a good idea of what 7 of the hours will bring. And if there's any positive to the Jabberjay attack, it's that it let us know where we are on the clock face again. Finnick weaves yet another water basket and a net for fishing. I take a quick swim and put more ointment on my skin. Then I sit at the edge of the water, cleaning the fish Finnick catches and watching the sun drop below the horizon. The bright moon is already on the rise, filling the arena with that strange twilight. We're about to settle down to our meal of raw fish when the anthem begins, and then the faces. Cashmere, Gloss, Wyrus, Mags, the woman from District 5, the morphling who gave her life for Peeta, Blight, the man from 10. 8 dead, plus 8 from the first night, 2/3 of us gone in a day and a half. That must be some kind of record.
They're really burning through us, says Joanna. Who's left, besides us five and District 2? Asks Finnick.
Chaff, says Peter, without needing to think about it. Perhaps he's been keeping an eye out for him because of Haymitch. A parachute comes down with a pile of bite-sized, square-shaped rolls.
These are from your district, right, Beatty? Peter asks.
Yes, from District 3, he says. How many are there?
Finnick counts them, turning each one over in his hands before he sets it in a neat configuration. I don't know what it is with Finnick and bread, but he seems obsessed with handling it.
24, he says.
And even 24 then, says Beatty.
24 on the nose, says Finnick. How should we divide them?
Let's each have 3, and whoever is still alive at breakfast can take a vote on the rest, says Joanna.
I don't know why this makes me laugh a little. I guess because it's true. When I do, Joanna gives me a look that's almost approving. No, not approving, but maybe slightly pleased.
We wait until the giant wave has flooded out of the 10 to 11 o'clock section, wait for the water to recede, and then go to that beach to make camp. Theoretically, we should have a full 12 hours of safety from the jungle. There's an unpleasant chorus of clicking, probably from some evil type of insect, coming from the 11 to 12 o'clock wedge. But whatever is making the sound stays within the confines of the jungle, and we keep off that part of the beach in case they're just waiting for a carelessly placed footfall to swarm out. I don't know how Joanna's still on her feet. She's only had about an hour of sleep since the game started. Peter and I volunteer for the first watch because we're better rested and because we want some time alone. The others go out immediately, although Finnick's sleep is restless. Every now and then I hear him murmuring Annie's name. Peter and I sit on the damp sand, facing away from each other, my right shoulder and hip pressed against his. I watch the water as he watches the jungle, which is better for me. I'm still haunted by the voices of the jabberjays, which unfortunately the insects can't drown out. After a while, I rest my head against his shoulder, feel his hand caress my hair.
Katniss, he says softly, it's no use pretending we don't know what the other one is trying to do.
No, I guess there isn't, but it's no fun discussing it either. Well, not for us, anyway. The Capitol viewers will be glued to their sets, so they don't miss one wretched word.
I don't know what kind of deal you think you've made with Haymitch, but you should know he made me promises as well.
Of course, I know this, too. He told Peter they could keep me alive so that he wouldn't be suspicious.
So I think we can assume he was lying to one of us.
This gets my attention. A double deal, a double promise. With only Haymitch knowing which one is real, I raise my head, meet Peter's eyes.
Why are you saying this now?
Because I don't want you forgetting how different our circumstances are. If you die, and I live, there's no life for me at all back in District 12. You're my whole life, he says. I would never be happy again.
I start to object, but he puts a finger to my lips.
It's different for you. I'm not saying it wouldn't be hard, but there are other people who'd make your life worth living.
Peter pulls the chain with the gold disc from around his neck. He holds it in the moonlight so I can clearly see the mockingjay. Then his thumb slides along a catch I didn't notice before, and the disc pops open. It's not solid, as I had thought, but a locket. And within the locket are photos. On the right side, my mother and Prim, laughing, and on the left, Gale, actually smiling. There is nothing in the world that could break me faster at this moment than these three faces. After what I heard this afternoon, it is the perfect weapon.
Your family needs you, Katniss, Peter says.
My family,
my mother, my sister, and my pretend cousin Gail. But Peeta's intention is clear, that Gail really is my family, or will be one day if I live, that I'll marry him. So Peeta's giving me his life and Gail at the same time, to let me know I shouldn't ever have doubts about it. Everything. That's what Peeta wants me to take from him. I wait for him to mention the baby, to play to the cameras, but he doesn't. And that's how I know that none of this is part of the games, that he is telling me the truth about what he feels.
No one really needs me, he says, and there's no self-pity in his voice.
It's true his family doesn't need him. They will mourn him, as will a handful of friends, but they will get on. Even Hamish, with the help of a lot of white liquor, will get on. I realize only one person will be damaged beyond repair if Peeta dies. Me.
I do, I say.
I need you. He looks upset, takes a deep breath, as if to begin a long argument. And that's no good. No good at all. Because he'll start going on about Prim and my mother and everything, and I'll just get confused. So before he can talk, I stop his lips with a kiss. I feel that thing again, the thing I only felt once before, in the cave last year, when I was trying to get Hamish to send us food. I kissed Peeta about 1,000 times during those games and after, but there was only one kiss that made me feel something stir deep inside, only one that made me want more. But my head wound started bleeding, and he made me lie down. This time there is nothing but us to interrupt us, and after a few attempts, Peeta gives up on talking. The sensation inside me grows warmer and spreads out from my chest, down through my body, out along my arms and legs, to the tips of my being. Instead of satisfying me, the kisses have the opposite effect of making my need greater. I thought I was something of an expert on hunger, but this is an entirely new kind. It's the first crack of the lightning storm, the bolt hitting the tree at midnight, that brings us to our senses. It rouses Finnick as well. He sits up with a sharp cry. I see his fingers digging into the sand as he reassures himself that whatever nightmare he inhabited wasn't real.
I can't sleep anymore, he says. One of you should rest.
Only then does he seem to notice our expressions, the way we're wrapped around each other.
Or both of you. I can watch alone.
Peeta won't let him, though.
It's too dangerous, he says. I'm not tired. You lie down, Katniss.
I don't object, because I do need to sleep, if I'm to be of any use keeping him alive. I let him lead me over to where the others are. He puts the chain with the locket around my neck, then rests his hand over the spot where our baby would be.
You're going to make a great mother, you know, he says.
He kisses me one last time and goes back to Finnick. His reference to the baby signals that our time out from the games is over, that he knows the audience will be wondering why he hasn't used the most persuasive argument in his arsenal, that sponsors must be manipulated. But as I stretch out on the sand, I wonder, could it be more? Like a reminder to me that I could still one day have kids with Gail. Well, if that was it, it was a mistake. Because for one thing, that's never been part of my plan. And for another, if only one of us can be a parent, anyone can see it should be Peeta. As I drift off, I try to imagine that world, somewhere in the future, with no games, no capital. A place like the meadow in the song I sang to Rue as she died, where Peeta's child could be safe.
Chapter 25. When I wake, I have a brief, delicious feeling of happiness that is somehow connected with Peeta. Happiness, of course, is a complete absurdity at this point,
since at the rate things are going, I'll be dead in a day. And that's the best-case scenario, if I'm able to eliminate the rest of the field, including myself, and get Peeta crowned as the winner of the Quarter Quell. Still, the sensation's so unexpected and sweet, I cling to it, if only for a few moments. Before the gritty sand, the hot sun, and my itching skin demand a return to reality. Everyone's already up and watching the descent of a parachute to the beach. I join them for another delivery of bread. It's identical to the one we received the night before. 24 rolls from District 3. That gives us 33 in all. We each take 5, leaving 8 in reserve. No one says it, but 8 will divide up perfectly after the next death. Somehow, in the light of day, joking about who will be around to eat the rolls has lost its humor. How long can we keep this alliance? I don't think anyone expected the number of tributes to drop so quickly. What if I am wrong about the others protecting Peeta? If things were simply coincidental, or it's all been a strategy to win our trust, to make us easy prey, or I don't understand what's actually going on. Wait, there's no ifs about that. I don't understand what's going on. And if I don't, it's time for Peeta and me to clear out of here. I sit next to Peeta on the sand to eat my rolls. For some reason, it's difficult to look at him. Maybe it was all that kissing last night. Although the two of us kissing isn't anything new, it might not even have felt any different for him. Maybe it's knowing the brief amount of time we have left and how we're working at such cross purposes when it comes to who should survive these games. After we eat, I take his hand and tug him toward the water. Come on, I'll teach you how to swim. I need to get him away from the others where we can discuss breaking away. It will be tricky, because once they realize we're severing the alliance, we'll be instant targets. If I was really teaching him to swim, I'd make him take off the belt, since it keeps him afloat, but what does it matter now? So I just show him the basic stroke, and let him practice going back and forth in waist-high water. At first, I notice Joanna keeping a careful eye on us, but eventually she loses interest and goes to take a nap. Finnick's weaving a new net out of vines, and Beatty plays with his wire. I know the time has come. While Peeta has been swimming, I've discovered something. My remaining scabs are starting to peel off. By gently rubbing a handful of sand up and down my arm, I clean off the rest of the scales, revealing fresh new skin underneath. I stop Peeta's practice on the pretext of showing him how to rid himself of the itchy scabs, and as we scrub ourselves, I bring up our escape. Look, the pool is down to 8. I think it's time we took off, I say under my breath, although I doubt any of the tributes can hear me. Peeta nods, and I can see him considering my proposition, weighing if the odds will be in our favor. Tell you what, he says. Let's stick around until Brutus and Inabaria are dead. I think Beatty's trying to put together some kind of trap for them now. Then, I promise, we'll go. I'm not entirely convinced, but if we leave now, we'll have 2 sets of adversaries after us. Maybe 3, because who knows what Chaff's up to. Plus, the clock to contend with. And then there's Beatty to think of. Joanna only brought him for me, and if we leave, she'll surely kill him. Then I remember, I can't protect Beatty, too. There can only be 1 victor, and it has to be Peeta. I must accept this. I must make decisions based on his survival only. All right, I say. We'll stay until the careers are dead, but that's the end of it. I turn and wave to Finnick. Hey, Finnick, come on in. We figured out how to make you pretty again. The 3 of us scour all the scabs from our bodies, helping with the others' backs, and come out the same pink as the sky. We apply another round of medicine because the skin seems too delicate for the sunlight, but it doesn't look half as bad on smooth skin and will be good camouflage in the jungle. Beatty calls us over, It turns out that during all those hours of fiddling with wire, he has indeed come up with a plan. I think we'll all agree our next job is to kill Brutus and Enobarria, he says mildly. I doubt they'll attack us openly again, now that they're so outnumbered. We could track them down, I suppose, but it's dangerous, exhausting work. Do you think they've figured out about the clock? I ask. If they haven't, they'll figure it out soon enough. Perhaps not as specifically as we have, but they must know that at least some of the zones are wired for attacks and that they are reoccurring in a circular fashion. Also, the fact that our last fight was cut off by Game Maker intervention will not have gone unnoticed by them. We know it was an attempt to disorient us, but they must be asking themselves why it was done. And this, too, may lead them to the realization that the arena's a clock, says Beatty. So I think our best bet will be setting our own trap. Wait, let me get Joanna up, says Finnick. She'll be rabid if she thinks she missed something this important. Or not, I mutter, since she's always pretty much rabid. But I don't stop him, because I'd be angry myself if I was excluded from a plan at this point. When she's joined us, Beatty shoos us all back a bit, so he can have room to work in the sand. He swiftly draws a circle and divides it into 12 wedges. It's the arena, not rendered in Peeta's precise strokes, but in the rough lines of a man whose mind is occupied by other, far more complex things. If you were Brutus and Enobarria, knowing what you do now about the jungle, where would you feel safest? Beatty asks. There's nothing patronizing in his voice, and yet I can't help thinking he reminds me of a schoolteacher about to ease children into a lesson. Perhaps it's the age difference, or simply that Beatty is probably about a million times smarter than the rest of us. Where we are now, on the beach, says Peeta. It's the safest place. So why aren't they on the beach? Says Beatty. Because we're here, says Joanna impatiently. Exactly. We're here, claiming the beach. Now where would you go? Says Beatty. I think about the deadly jungle, the occupied beach. I'd hide just at the edge of the jungle, so I could escape if an attack came, and so I could spy on us.
Also to eat, Finnick says. The jungle's full of strange creatures and plants, but by watching us, I'd know the seafood's safe.
Beatty smiles at us as if we've exceeded his expectations.
Yes, good. You do see. Now here's what I propose. A 12 o'clock strike. What happens exactly at noon and at midnight?
The lightning bolt hits the tree, I say.
Yes. So what I'm suggesting is that after the bolt hits at noon, but before it hits at midnight, we run my wire from that tree all the way down into the salt water, which is, of course, highly conductive. When the bolt strikes, the electricity will travel down the wire and into not only the water, but also the surrounding beach, which will still be damp from the 10 o'clock wave. Anyone in contact with those surfaces at that moment will be electrocuted, says Beatty.
There's a long pause while we all digest Beatty's plan. Seems a bit fantastical to me, impossible even. But why? I've set thousands of snares. Isn't this just a larger snare with a more scientific component? Could it work? How can we even question it? We tributes trained to gather fish and lumber and coal. What do we know about harnessing power from the sky?
Peeta takes a stab at it.
Will that wire really be able to conduct that much power, Beatty? It looks so fragile, like it would just burn up.
Oh, it will, but not until the current has passed through it. It will act something like a fuse, in fact, except the electricity will travel along it, says Beatty.
How do you know? Asks Joanna, clearly not convinced.
Because I invented it, says Beatty, as if slightly surprised. It's not actually wire in the usual sense, nor is the lightning natural lightning, nor the tree a real tree. You know trees better than any of us, Joanna. It would be destroyed by now, wouldn't it?
Yes, she says glumly.
Don't worry about the wire.
It'll do just what I say, Beatty assures us. And where will we be when this happens? Asks Finnick.
Far enough up in the jungle to be safe, Beatty replies.
The careers will be safe too, then, unless they're in the vicinity of the water, I point out.
That's right, says Beatty.
But all the seafood will be cooked, says Peeta.
Probably more than cooked, says Beatty. We will most likely be eliminating that as a food source for good. But you found other edible things in the jungle, right, Katniss?
Yes, nuts and rats, I say. And we have sponsors.
Well, then, I don't see that as a problem, says Beatty. But as we are allies, and this will require all our efforts, the decision of whether or not to attempt it is up to you four.
We are like school children, completely unable to dispute his theory with anything but the most elementary concerns, most of which don't even have anything to do with his actual plan. I look at the others' disconcerted faces.
Why not? I say. If it fails, there's no harm done. If it works, there's a decent chance we'll kill them.
And even if we don't, and just kill the seafood, Brutus and Enobaria lose it as a food source, too.
I say we try it, says Peeta. Katniss is right.
Finnick looks at Joanna and raises his eyebrows. He will not go forward without her.
All right, she says finally. It's better than hunting them down in the jungle anyway, and I doubt they'll figure out our plan since we can barely understand it ourselves.
Beatty wants to inspect the lightning tree before he has to rig it. Judging by the sun, it's about 9 in the morning. We have to leave our beach soon anyway, so we break camp, walk over to the beach that borders the lightning section, and head into the jungle. Beatty's still too weak to hike up the slope on his own, so Finnick and Peeta take turns carrying him. I let Joanna lead because it's a pretty straight shot up to the tree, and I figure she can't get us too lost. Besides, I can do a lot more damage with a sheath of arrows than she can with two axes, so I'm the best one to bring up the rear. The dense, muggy air weighs on me. There's been no break from it since the games began. I wish Haymitch would stop sending us that District 3 bread and get us some more of that District 4 stuff, because I've sweated out buckets in the last 2 days, and even though I've had the fish, I'm craving salt. A piece of ice would be another good idea, or a cold drink of water. I'm grateful for the fluid from the trees, but it's the same temperature as the seawater and the air and the other tributes and me. We're all just one big warm stew. As we near the tree, Finnick suggests I take the lead.
Katniss can hear the force field, he explains to Beatty and Joanna.
Hear it? Asks Beatty.
Only with the ear the capital reconstructed, I say. Guess who I'm not fooling with that story? Beatty, because surely he remembers that he showed me how to spot a force field, and probably it's impossible to hear force fields anyway, but for whatever reason, he doesn't question my claim.
Then by all means, let Katniss go first, he says,
pausing a moment to wipe the steam off his glasses.
Force fields are nothing to play around with.
The lightning tree's unmistakable as it towers so high above the others. I find a bunch of nuts and make everybody wait while I move slowly up the slope, tossing the nuts ahead of me. But I see the force field almost immediately, even before a nut hits it, because it's only about 15 yards away. My eyes, which are sweeping the greenery before me, catch sight of the rippled square high up and to my right. I throw a nut directly in front of me and hear it sizzle in confirmation.
Just stay below the lightning tree, I tell the others.
We divide up duties. Finnick guards Beatty while he examines the tree. Joanna taps for water. Peeta gathers nuts, and I hunt nearby. The tree rats don't seem to have any fear of humans, so I take down 3 easily. The sound of the 10 o'clock wave reminds me I should get back, and I return to the others and clean my kill. Then I draw a line in the dirt a few feet from the force field as a reminder to keep back, and Peeta and I
settle down to roast nuts and sear cubes of rat. Beatty is still messing around the tree, doing I don't know what, taking measurements and such. At one point, he snaps off a sliver of bark, joins us, and throws it against the force field. It bounces back and lands on the ground, glowing. In a few moments, it returns to its original color.
"Well, that explains a lot," says Beatty.
I look at Peter and can't help biting my lip to keep from laughing, since it explains absolutely nothing to anyone but Beatty. About this time, we hear the sound of clicks rising from the sector adjacent to us. That means it's 11 o'clock. It's far louder in the jungle than it was on the beach last night. We all listen intently.
"It's not mechanical," Beatty says decidedly.
"I'd guess insects," I say. "Maybe beetles."
"Something with pincers," adds Finnick.
The sound swells, as if alerted by our quiet words to the proximity of live flesh. Whatever is making that clicking, I bet it could strip us to the bone in seconds.
"We should get out of here anyway," says Joanna. "There's less than an hour before the lightning starts."
We don't go that far, though, only to the identical tree in the blood rain section. We have a picnic of sorts, squatting on the ground, eating our jungle food, waiting for the bolt that signals noon. At Beatty's request, I climb up into the canopy as the clicking begins to fade out. When the lightning strikes, it's dazzling, even from here, even in this bright sunlight. It completely encompasses the distant tree, making it glow a hot blue-white and causing the surrounding air to crackle with electricity. I swing down and report my findings to Beatty, who seems satisfied, even if I'm not terribly scientific. We take a circuitous route back to the 10 o'clock beach. The sand is smooth and damp, swept clean by the recent wave. Beatty essentially gives us the afternoon off while he works with the wire. Since it's his weapon and the rest of us have to defer to his knowledge so entirely, there's the odd feeling of being let out of school early. At first we take turns having naps in the shadowy edge of the jungle, but by late afternoon everyone is awake and restless. We decide, since this might be our last chance at seafood, to make a sort of feast of it. Under Finnick's guidance, we spear fish and gather shellfish, even dive for oysters. I like this last part best. Not because I have any great appetite for oysters. I only ever tasted them once in the capital, and I couldn't get around the sliminess. But it's lovely deep down under the water, like being in a different world. The water's very clear, and schools of bright-hued fish and strange sea flowers decorate the sand floor. Joanna keeps watch while Finnick, Peter, and I clean and lay out the seafood. Peter's just pried open an oyster when I hear him give a laugh.
"Hey, look at this!"
He holds up a glistening, perfect pearl about the size of a pea.
"You know, if you put enough pressure on coal, it turns to pearls," he says earnestly to Finnick.
"No, it doesn't," says Finnick dismissively.
But I crack up, remembering that's how a clueless Effie Trinket presented us to the people of the capital last year, before anyone knew us, as coal pressured into pearls by our weighty existence, beauty that arose out of pain. Peter rinses the pearl off in the water and hands it to me.
"For you."
I hold it out on my palm and examine its iridescent surface in the sunlight. Yes, I will keep it. For the few remaining hours of my life, I will keep it close. This last gift from Peter, the only one I can really accept. Perhaps it will give me strength in the final moments. "Thanks," I say, closing my fist around it. I look coolly into the blue eyes of the person who is now my greatest opponent, the person who would keep me alive at his own expense, and I promise myself I will defeat his plan. The laughter drains from those eyes, and they are staring so intensely into mine, it's like they can read my thoughts.
The locket didn't work, did it?
Peeta says, even though Finnick is right there, even though everyone can hear him.
Katniss?
It worked, I say.
But not the way I wanted it to,
he says, averting his glance. After that, he will look at nothing but oysters. Just as we're about to eat, a parachute appears, bearing two supplements to our meal. A small pot of spicy red sauce, and yet another round of rolls from District 3. Finnick, of course, immediately counts them.
24 again, he says.
32 rolls, then. So we each take 5, leaving 7, which will never divide equally. It's bread for only one. The salty fish flesh, the succulent shellfish, even the oysters seem tasty, vastly improved by the sauce. We gorge ourselves until no one can hold another bite, and even then there are leftovers. They won't keep, though, so we toss all the remaining food back into the water so the couriers won't get it when we leave. No one bothers about the shells. The waves should clear those away.
There's nothing to do now but wait. Peeta and I sit at the edge of the water, hand in hand, wordless.
He gave his speech last night, but it didn't change my mind, and nothing I can say will change his. The time for persuasive gifts is over. I have the pearl, though, secured in a parachute with the spile and the medicine at my waist. I hope it makes it back to District 12. Surely my mother and Prim will know to return it to Peeta before they bury my body.
Chapter 26.
The anthem begins, but there are no faces in the sky tonight. The audience will be restless, thirsting for blood. Beatty's trap holds enough promise, though, that the game makers haven't sent in other attacks. Perhaps they are simply curious to see if it will work. At what Finnick and I judge to be about 9, we leave our shell-strewn camp, cross to the 12 o'clock beach, and begin to quietly hike up to the lightning tree in the light of the moon. Our full stomachs make us more uncomfortable and breathless than we were on the morning's climb. I begin to regret those last dozen oysters. Beatty asks Finnick to assist him, and the rest of us stand guard. Before he even attaches any wire to the tree, Beatty unrolls yards and yards of the stuff. He has Finnick secure it tightly around a broken branch and lay it on the ground. Then they stand on either side of the tree, passing the spool back and forth as they wrap the wire around and around the trunk. At first it seems arbitrary. Then I see a pattern, like an intricate maze, appearing in the moonlight on Beatty's side. I wonder if it makes any difference how the wire's placed, or if this is merely to add to the speculation of the audience. I bet most of them know as much about electricity as I do. The work on the trunk's completed, just as we hear the wave begin. I've never really worked out at what point in the 10 o'clock hour it erupts. There must be some build-up, then the wave itself, then the aftermath of the flooding, but the sky tells me 10:30. This is when Beatty reveals the rest of the plan. Since we move most swiftly through the trees, he wants Joanna and me to take the coil down through the jungle, unwinding the wire as we go. We are to lay it across the 12 o'clock beach and drop the metal spool with whatever is left deep into the water, making sure it sinks, then run for the jungle. If we go now, right now, we should make it to safety.
I want to go with them as a guard,
Peeta says immediately. After the moment with the pearl, I know he's less willing than ever to let me out of his sight.
You're too slow. Besides, I'll need you on this end. Katniss will guard, says Beatty. There's no time to debate this. I'm sorry. If the girls are to get out of there alive, they need to move now.
He hands the coil to Joanna. I don't like the plan any more than Peeta does,
How can I protect him at a distance? But Beatty's right. With his leg, Peter is too slow to make it down the slope in time. Joanna and I are the fastest and most sure-footed on the jungle floor. I can't think of any alternative. And if I trust anyone here besides Peter, it's Beatty.
It's okay, I tell Peter. We'll just drop the coil and come straight back up.
Not into the lightning zone, Beatty reminds me. Head for the tree in the 1 to 2 o'clock sector. If you find you're running out of time, move over one more. Don't even think about going back on the beach, though, until I can assess the damage.
I take Peter's face in my hands. Don't worry, I'll see you at midnight.
I give him a kiss, and before he can object any further, I let go and turn to Joanna.
Ready?
Why not? Says Joanna with a shrug. She's clearly no happier about being teamed up than I am. But we're all caught up in Beatty's trap.
You guard, I'll unwind. We can trade off later.
Without further discussion, we head down the slope. In fact, there's very little discussion between us at all. We move at a pretty good clip, one manning the coil, the other keeping watch. About halfway down, we hear the clicking beginning to rise, indicating it's after 11.
Better hurry, Joanna says. I want to put a lot of distance between me and that water before the lightning hits, just in case Volts miscalculated something.
I'll take the coil for a while, I say. It's harder work laying out the wire than guarding, and she's had a long turn.
Here, Joanna says, passing me the coil.
Both of our hands are still on the metal cylinder when there's a slight vibration. Suddenly, the thin golden wire from above springs down at us, bunching in tangled loops and curls around our wrists. Then the severed end snakes up to our feet. It only takes a second to register this rapid turn of events. Joanna and I look at each other, but neither of us has to say it. Someone not far above us has cut the wire, and they will be on us at any moment. My hand frees itself from the wire and has just closed on the feathers of an arrow when the metal cylinder smashes into the side of my head. The next thing I know, I'm lying on my back in the vines, a terrible pain in my left temple. Something's wrong with my eyes. My vision blurs in and out of focus as I strain to make the two moons floating up in the sky into one. It's hard to breathe, and I realize Joanna's sitting on my chest, pinning me at the shoulders with her knees. There's a stab in my left forearm. I try to jerk away, but I'm still too incapacitated. Joanna's digging something, I guess the point of her knife, into my flesh, twisting it around. There's an excruciating ripping sensation, and warmth runs down my wrist, filling my palm. She swipes down my arm and coats half my face with my blood.
Stay down, she hisses.
Her weight leaves my body, and I'm alone. Stay down, I think. What? What is happening? My eyes shut, blocking out the inconsistent world as I try to make sense of my situation. All I can think of is Joanna shoving Wyrus to the beach.
Just stay down, will you?
But she didn't attack Wyrus, not like this. I'm not Wyrus anyway. I'm not nuts.
Just stay down, will you?
Echoes around inside my brain. Footsteps coming, two pairs, heavy, not trying to conceal their whereabouts. Brutus's voice.
She's good as dead. Come on, Inavaria.
Feet moving into the night. Am I? I drift in and out of consciousness looking for an answer. Am I as good as dead? I'm in no position to make an argument to the contrary. In fact, rational thinking is a struggle. This much I know. Joanna attacked me, smashed that cylinder into my head, cut my arm, probably doing irreparable damage to veins and arteries, and then Brutus and Inobaria showed up before she had time to finish me off. The alliance is over. Finnick and Joanna must have had an agreement to turn on us tonight. I knew we should have left this morning. I don't know where Beatty stands, but I'm fair game, and so is Peter.